Welcome to the Rapid Learning Center audio tutorial on Personality Psychology. By completing this tutorial, you will be able to compare and contrast the main perspectives in personality psychology, outline the contributions of Sigmund Freud to personality psychology, explain the humanistic perspective using Maslow's hierarchy of needs, list the five big factors of the trait perspective, and appreciate the influence of culture on personality. This tutorial will explore personality psychology, and as such, we will cover three main topics. After a brief introduction, we will first explore historical perspectives on personality psychology to include the psychoanalytic and humanistic perspectives. We will then explore more contemporary perspectives to include the trait and social cognitive perspectives. We will complete this tutorial with an exploration of how personality psychologists view personality differences by focusing on the sense of self, self-esteem, the influence of culture, and finishing with a look at the modern unconscious mind. Many of the topics explored in psychology deal with our similarities, such as how we all develop, perceive, learn, remember, think, and feel. This tutorial emphasizes our individuality. Your individual personality is your characteristic pattern of thinking, feeling, and acting. If our behavior pattern is strikingly distinctive and consistent, for example, if you are always outgoing, whether at a party or in a classroom, people are likely to say that you have a strong personality. However, even as we explore our differences, it is important to keep in mind that the other topics in psychology tend to relate back to personality. For example, we can consider the biological influences of personality, personality development across the lifespan, and personality-related aspects of learning, motivation, emotion, and health. In this tutorial, we will first explore and evaluate key historic perspectives on personality, and then we will consider contemporary research on our enduring traits and sense of self. In our first topic, we will explore historic perspectives. We will start with a look at the psychoanalytic perspective and then shift to an exploration of the humanistic approach. Sigmund Freud is undoubtedly the most notable deceased psychologist known to the general population. Freud had a remarkable memory even at a young age and entered the University of Vienna in 1873. He went on to medical school and then set up a private practice in which he specialized in nervous disorders. Before long, however, he faced patients whose disorders made no neurological sense. Freud's search for a cause for such disorders sent him on a new quest. His views evolved as he treated patients and analyzed himself, and eventually filled 24 volumes that were published between 1888 and 1939. Not everyone agrees with his ideas, and yet it is undeniable that he did leave his mark on human self-understanding. Freud explored the possibility that some neurological disorders may have a psychological rather than a physiological cause. This exploration led to his discovery of the unconscious. Initially, Freud thought hypnosis might unlock the door to the unconscious, but patients displayed an uneven capacity for hypnosis, so he then returned to free association. To induce free association, Freud would ask his patient to relax and say whatever came to mind, no matter how embarrassing or trivial. He then assumed that a line of mental dominoes had fallen from his patient's distant past to their troubled present. He believed that free association allowed him to trace that line back, producing a chain of thought leading to the patient's unconscious, thereby retrieving and releasing painful unconscious memories, often from childhood. Freud called his theory and association techniques psychoanalysis. Underlying Freud's psychoanalytic conception of personality was his belief that the mind is like an iceberg, mostly hidden. Our conscious awareness is the part of the iceberg that floats above the surface. Below the surface is a much larger unconscious region containing thoughts, wishes, feelings, and memories, of which we are unaware. Some of these thoughts we store temporarily in a preconscious area from which we can retrieve them into conscious awareness. Of greater interest to Freud was the mass of unacceptable passions and thoughts that he believed we repress or forcibly block from our consciousness because it would be too unsettling to acknowledge. Freud believed that, although we are not consciously aware of them, these troublesome feelings and ideas powerfully influence us. In his view, our unacknowledged impulses express themselves in disguised forms, the work we choose, the beliefs we hold, our daily habits, and our troubling symptoms. For Freud the determinist, nothing was ever accidental. He believed he could glimpse the unconscious seeping not only into people's free associations, beliefs, habits, and symptoms, but also into their dreams and slips of tongue and pen. He viewed jokes as expressions of repressed sexual and aggressive tendencies, and dreams as the royal road to the unconscious. By analyzing people's dreams, Freud believed he could reveal the nature of their inner conflicts and release their inner tensions. In Freud's view, human personality, including its emotions and strivings, arises from a conflict between our aggressive, pleasure-seeking biological impulses and the internalized social restraints against them. Freud believed personality is a result of our efforts to resolve this basic conflict, to express these impulses in ways that bring satisfaction without also bringing guilt or punishment. Freud theorized that the conflict centers on three interacting systems, id, ego, and superego. Freud found these abstract psychological concepts useful aids to understanding the mind's dynamics. The id has a reservoir of unconscious psychic energy, constantly striving to satisfy basic drives to survive, reproduce, and aggress. The id operates on the pleasure principle. If not constrained by reality, it seeks immediate gratification. The ego, operating on the reality principle, seeks to gratify the id's impulses in realistic ways that will bring long-term pleasure rather than pain or destruction. The ego contains our partially conscious perceptions, thoughts, judgments, and memories. The superego is the voice of conscience that forces the ego to consider not only the real, but the ideal, and that focuses solely on how one ought to behave. The superego strives for perfection, judging actions and producing positive feelings of pride or negative feelings of guilt. Because the superego's demands often oppose the id's, the ego struggles to reconcile the two. It is the personality executive mediating the impulsive demands of the id, the restraining demands of the superego, and the real-life demands of the external world. Analysis of his patients' histories convinced Freud that personality forms during life's first few years. Again and again, his patients' symptoms seemed rooted in unresolved conflicts from early childhood. He concluded that children pass through a series of psychosexual stages during which the id's pleasure-seeking energies focus on distinct pleasure-sensitive areas of the body, called erogenous zones. The oral stage occurs from 0 to 18 months of age and involves a focus on pleasure in the mouth, such as sucking, biting, and chewing. The anal stage occurs from 18 months to 36 months and involves pleasure focused on bowel and bladder elimination and involves coping with demands for control. The phallic stage occurs from 3 to 6 years of age, in which the pleasure zone is the genitals and involves coping with incestuous sexual feelings. The latency stage occurs from 6 years to puberty and focuses on dormant sexual feelings. The final genital stage occurs from puberty onward and focuses on maturation of sexual interests. In Freud's view, maladaptive behavior in the adult results from conflicts unresolved during earlier psychosexual stages. At any point in the oral, anal, or phallic stages, strong conflict can lock or fixate the person's pleasure-seeking energies in that stage. According to Freud, anxiety is the price we pay for civilization. As members of social groups, we must control our sexual and aggressive impulses, not act them out. But sometimes the ego fears losing control of this inner war between the demands of the id and the superego, and the result is a black cloud of unfocused anxiety, which leaves us feeling unsettled but unsure why. At such times, Freud proposed the ego protects itself with defense mechanisms. These tactics reduce or redirect anxiety in various ways, but always by distorting reality. We also cope with anxiety through regression, which is the act of retreating into an earlier, more infantile stage of development. Thus, when facing the anxious first days of school, a child may regress to the oral comfort of thumb sucking. In reaction formation, the ego unconsciously makes unacceptable impulses that look like their opposites. En route to consciousness, the unacceptable proposition, "I hate him," becomes, "I love him." Timidity becomes daring. Feelings of inadequacy become bravado. Projection, according to Freud, disguises threatening impulses by attributing them to others. Thus, "he doesn't trust me" may be a projection of the actual feeling, "I don't trust him," or "I don't trust myself." The familiar mechanism of rationalization occurs when we unconsciously generate self-justifying explanations to hide from ourselves the real reasons for our actions. Thus, habitual drinkers may say they drink with their friends just to be sociable. Displacement diverts one's sexual or aggressive impulses towards an object or person that is psychologically more acceptable than the one that aroused the feelings. Children who fear expressing anger against their parents may display it by kicking the family dog. Students upset over an exam may snap at a roommate. All of these defense mechanisms function indirectly and unconsciously, reducing anxiety by disguising our threatening impulses. Those who study personality or provide therapy need ways to evaluate personality characteristics. Methods of assessment differ because they are tailored to different personality theories. A tool tailored to Freud's psychoanalytical perspective would need to start with his belief that the significant influences on our personalities arise from the unconscious. Psychoanalysis dismisses objective assessment tools, such as agree-disagree or true-false questionnaires, as merely tapping the conscious surface. Tools used to test the unconscious include the projective tests, such as the thematic appreciation test and the Rorschach ink block test. Projective tests present an ambiguous stimulus and then ask test takers to describe it or tell a story about it. The stimulus has no inherent significance, so any meaning people read into it presumably is a projection of their interests and conflicts. This was promoted by Henry Murray in 1933. A few years later, Murray introduced the Thematic Appreciation Test, or TAT, in which people viewed ambiguous pictures and then made up stories about them. One use has been to assess achievement motivation. Other projective tests ask test takers to draw a person, to complete sentences, or to provide the first word that comes to mind after the examiner says a test word. Most widely used is the famous Rorschach ink blot test, introduced in 1921 by Hermann Rorschach. The test assumes that what we see in its 10 ink blots reflects our inner feelings and conflicts. If we see predatory animals or weapons, the examiner may infer we have aggressive tendencies. But are projective assessment tests reasonable? If so, then the use of the ink blots will allow the psychologist to understand one's personality and diagnose an emotional disorder. How good is the Rorschach test as far as reliability and validity? There is no universally accepted system for scoring and interpreting the test, nor has the test been very successful at predicting behavior or at discriminating between groups, for example, identifying who is suicidal and who is not. But this test is widely used and cherished. As late as the year 2000, 82% of clinicians reported using this test, and judges continue to receive Rorschach-based assessments of criminals' violent potential. Therapists use it to probe for past sexual abuse. Other clinicians view it as a diagnostic tool. There is even a research-based computer-aided coding and interpretation tool that aims to improve agreement among raters and enhance the test's validity. But the evidence is insufficient for many researchers who find no scientific basis for justifying its use. Freud himself probably would have been uncomfortable with trying to diagnose patients based on tests and be more interested in the therapist-patient interactions that take place during the test. Freud's writings were controversial, but soon found many followers who were mostly young, ambitious physicians who formed an inner circle around their strong-minded leaders. When there were disagreements, these people would leave or be cast out, but even these people would still reflect Freud's influence. These pioneering psychoanalysts we now call neo-Freudians, because they accepted Freud's basic ideas of the structures of id, ego, and superego, the importance of the unconscious, the shaping of personality in childhood, and the dynamics of anxiety and the defense mechanisms. But they did veer away from Freud in two important ways. They placed more emphasis on the role of the conscious mind, both in interpreting experience and in coping with the environment. And secondly, they doubted that sex and aggression were all-consuming motivations. Instead, they placed more emphasis on loftier motives and on social interactions. Carl Jung was one of these disciple-turned-dissenters of Freud. Jung placed less emphasis on social factors and agreed with Freud that the unconscious exerts a powerful influence. But to Jung, the unconscious contains more than our repressed thoughts and feelings. He believed we also have a collective unconscious, a common reservoir of images derived from our species' universal experiences. Jung said that the collective unconscious explains why, for many people, spiritual concerns are deeply rooted and why people in different cultures share certain myths and images. Today's psychologists discount the idea of inherited experiences, but many do believe that our shared evolutionary history shaped some universal dispositions. When we view Freud in light of modern research, it is important to remember that Freud did not have access to all that we have since learned about human development, thinking, and emotion. He knew nothing about neurotransmitters or DNA. When we critique Freud from our current perspective, it is also important to remember that our perspective is itself subject to revision. Both admirers and critics agree that recent research contradicts many of Freud's specific ideas. Today's developmental psychologists see our development as lifelong, not fixed in childhood. They doubt that infants' neural networks were mature enough to sustain as much emotional trauma as Freud assumed. Freud's ideas about childhood sexuality arose from his rejection of stories of childhood sexual abuse told by his female patients, stories that some scholars believe he suggested, coerced, or later misremembered, then attributed to their own childhood sexual wishes and conflicts. Today, we understand how Freud's questioning may have created false memories, and we also know that childhood sexual abuse does happen. New ideas about why we dream dispute Freud's belief that dreams disguise unfulfilled wishes. Researchers also find little support for Freud's idea that defense mechanisms disguise sexual and aggressive impulses, although there is evidence that these do help to protect our self-esteem. Even Freud's central belief that sexual suppression causes psychological disorders does not appear to stand up to the test of time, since sexual suppression has diminished over time, whereas psychological disorders have not. Another central question regarding Freud's theories is if repression actually exists, or if it is indeed a myth. Freud's entire psychoanalysis theory rests on his assumption that the human mind often represses painful experiences, banishing them to the unconscious. Freud and his followers thought that if we could somehow uncover our past experiences, we would find them intact. If we could then recover and resolve the painful repressed memories of our childhood, emotional healing would follow. repression became one of popular psychology's most widely accepted concepts. However, many of today's researchers contend that repression, if it ever occurs, is a rare mental response to terrible trauma. Some researchers believe that extreme, prolonged stress, such as the stress some severely abused children experience, may disrupt memory by damaging the hippocampus. However, research also finds that short-term high stress actually enhances memory, and negative emotional events are therefore remembered well. Traumatic events such as rape and torture haunt survivors who experience unwanted flashbacks. Psychologists also criticize Freud's theory for its scientific shortcomings. Good scientific theories explain observations and offer testable hypotheses. Freud's theory rests on few objective observations and offers few hypotheses to verify or reject. For Freud, his own recollections and interpretations of patients' free associations, dreams, and slips were evidence enough. Freud's theory offers after-the-fact explanations for any characteristic, yet fails to predict such behavior or traits. A person's behavior after an event can be interpreted in opposite ways using Freud's theory. For example, what would be the person's reaction after their mother has died? If they feel angry after the death, then Freud would say your unresolved childhood dependency needs were threatened. But if you did not feel angry, he would say you are repressing your anger. So the scientific world has seen a steady decay of Freud's theories, whereas the popular press, Hollywood, and the general public still seem to hang on to his ideas that childhood experiences alone mold personality, that dramas have meaning, and that many behaviors have disguised motives. As we complete this topic of the tutorial, use these true-false questions to test your knowledge. According to Freud, the id is the voice of consciousness that focuses on how one ought to behave, strives for perfection, and produces pride and guilt, true or false. According to Freud, repression underlies all the other defense mechanisms, true or false. Carl Jung believed we all experience a collective consciousness, true or false. Well, according to Freud, it is the superego that is the voice of consciousness, not the id, that focuses on how one ought to behave, strives for perfection, and produces pride and guilt. But it is true that, according to Freud, repression underlies all the other defense mechanisms. It is also true that Carl Jung believed we all experience collective consciousness. By 1960, some personality psychologists had become discontented with Freud's negativity. In contrast to Freud's study of the base motives of sick people, these humanistic psychologists focus on the healthy people and how they strive for self-determination and self-realization. Two pioneering theorists, Abraham Maslow and Carl Rogers, illustrate this emphasis on human potential and seeing the world through the person's eyes. Let's look at each of these two men in a bit more detail. Abraham Maslow lived from 1908 to 1970. Maslow proposed that we are motivated by a hierarchy of needs. If our physiological needs are met, we become concerned with personal safety. If we achieve a sense of security, we then seek to love, to be loved, and to love ourselves. With our love needs satisfied, we seek self-esteem. Having achieved self-esteem, we ultimately seek self-actualization, the process of fulfilling our potential. Maslow developed his ideas by studying healthy, creative people. Characteristics of these people included being self-aware and self-accepting, open and spontaneous, loving and caring, and not paralyzed by others' opinions. Secure in their sense of who they were, their interests were problem-centered rather than self-centered. They focused their energies on a particular task, one they often regarded as their mission of life. Most enjoyed a few deep relationships rather than many superficial ones. Many have been moved by spiritual or personal peak experiences that surpassed ordinary consciousness. Fellow humanistic psychologist Carl Rogers agreed with much of Maslow's thinking. Rogers believed that people were basically good and are endowed with self-actualizing tendencies. Unless thwarted by an environment that inhibits growth, each of us is like an acorn, primed for growth and fulfillment. Rogers believed that a growth-promoting climate required three conditions: genuineness, acceptance, and empathy. Being genuine involves being open about their own feelings, dropping their facades, and being transparent and self-disclosing. Acceptance involves unconditional positive regard. This is an attitude that values us even knowing our failings. Empathetic involves sharing and mirroring our feelings and reflecting our meanings. Thus, for both Rogers and Maslow, a central feature of personality is one's self-concept. All the thoughts and feelings we have in response to the questions, who am I? If our self-concept is positive, we tend to act and perceive the world positively. According to Rogers, if it is negative, if in our own eyes we fall far short of our ideal self, we feel dissatisfied and unhappy. A worthwhile goal for the therapist, parents, teachers, and friends is therefore, he said, to help others know, accept, and be true to themselves. Humanistic psychologists sometimes assessed personality by asking people to fill out questionnaires that would evaluate self-concept. One questionnaire, inspired by Carl Rogers, asked people to describe themselves both as they would ideally like to be and as they actually are. When the ideal and the actual self are nearly alike, said Rogers, the self-concept is positive. When assessing his client's personal growth during therapy, he looked for successively closer ratings of actual and ideal self. Some humanistic psychologists believe that any standardized assessment of personality is depersonalizing, that even a questionnaire detaches the psychologist from the living human. Rather than forcing the person to respond to narrow categories, these psychologists presumed that interviews and intimate conversations would provide a better understanding of each person's unique experiences. The impact of humanistic psychologists, though waning, has been pervasive. Their ideas have influenced counseling, education, child rearing, and management. They have also influenced much of today's popular psychology. Many people have absorbed Maslow's and Rogers' ideas regarding a positive self-concept, but have extended it to being the key to happiness and success. They have also absorbed the concept of acceptance and empathy being able to help nurture positive feelings about oneself, and that people are basically good and capable of self-improvement. Perhaps one reason the message has been so well received is that it emphasizes the individual self, and the individual self reflects and reinforces Western cultural values. The prominence of the humanistic perspective set off a backlash of criticism. To the critics, its concepts are vague and subjective. Further, the individualist characteristics put forth by Carl Rogers can also lead to self-indulgence, selfishness, and an erosion of moral restraints. A final accusation leveled against humanistic psychology is that it fails to appreciate the reality of our human capacity for evil. Faced with global warming, overpopulation, and the spread of nuclear weapons, we may become apathetic from either of two rationalizations. One is a naive optimism that denies the threat. Since people are basically good, everything will eventually work out. The other is a dark despair. It's hopeless, so why try? Action requires enough realism to fuel concern and enough optimism to provide hope. According to the critics, humanistic psychology encourages the needed hope, but not the equally necessary realism about evil. Even within humanistic psychology, there has been debate over whether people are basically good. Carl Rogers clearly thought so. Although aware of the incredible amount of cruel, destructive behavior in the world, he did not find that this evil is inherent in human nature. He stated that he had never known an individual who, if given growth-promoting conditions, had chosen the cruel or destructive path. Evil, in his view, springs not from human nature, but from toxic cultural influences, including the constricting, destructive influence of our educational system, the injustice of our distribution of wealth, and our cultivated prejudices against individuals who are different. The opposing viewpoint was championed by fellow humanistic psychologist Rollo May, who did agree that the cultural context mattered, but who makes up the culture except persons like you and me? The culture is evil as well as good because we, according to May, the human beings who constitute it, are evil as well as good. The debate continues. As we complete this topic, take a moment to attempt the following matching question regarding the humanistic perspective of personality psychology. Connect the term with the characteristic. Then check and see if you're right. The terms are Carl Rogers, Rollo May, Maslow's highest level of need, and humanistic perspective. The characteristics are to live up to one's fullest and unique potential, self-concept as a central feature, focus on healthy ways people strive for self-determination and self-realization, and cultural context matters, but culture is made up of people. How would you match these? Well, Carl Rogers theorized that self-concept is a central feature in personality psychology. Rollo May believed that cultural context matters, but that it is made up of people who can be either or both good and evil. Maslow's highest level of need is to live up to one's fullest and unique potential. And the humanistic perspective of personality psychology involves a focus on healthy ways people strive for self-determination and self-realization. In our next topic, we will explore personality psychology throughout a view of contemporary perspectives. We will first delve into the trait perspective and then finish with a look at the social cognitive perspective. Let's begin. Today's personality researchers are less interested in grand theories than in focused analysis of basic dimensions of personality and their impact on behavior, on the biological roots of these basic dimensions, on the interaction of persons and environments, and on studies of self-esteem, self-serving bias, and cultural influences on one's sense of self. Therefore, in this tutorial, we will focus on these current interests. We will explore the trait perspective, the social cognitive perspective, and then delve into the studies of the self. It was Gordon Allport who attempted to do what Freud did not do, to describe personality in terms of fundamental traits. Traits are people's characteristic behaviors and conscious motives. Allport came to define personality in terms of identifiable behavior patterns. He was concerned less with explaining individual traits than with describing them. One way of describing and classifying personality is by defining broad personality types. In 1954, psychologist William Sheldon classified people by body type. Santa Claus typifies the plump endomorph, relaxed and jolly. Superman typifies the muscular mesomorph, bold and physically active. Sherlock Holmes typifies the thin ectomorph, high-strung and solitary. But are different body types actually associated with different personalities? When researchers assess people's body types and personalities separately, there is a linkage, but it is modest. The stereotypes of the chubby, happy-go-lucky person and the muscular, confident person turn out to be just that, stereotypes that exaggerate a mere kernel of truth. More popular today, especially in business and career counseling, is an effort to classify people according to Carl Jung's personality types, based on their responses to 126 questions written by Isabel Briggs Myers in 1987 and her mother, Kathleen Briggs. The Myers-Briggs type indicator is quite simple. It offers choices, then it counts the test taker's preferences, labels them as indicating a specific type, and feeds them back to the person in complimentary terms. Most people agree with their announced type profile. It, after all, mirrors their declared preferences. They may also accept their label as a basis for being matched with work partners and tasks that supposedly suit their temperament. Classifying people as one or another distinct personality type fails to capture their full individuality. So how else can we describe their personalities? One method developed involves placing people on several trait dimensions simultaneously, and therefore allows psychologists to describe countless individual personality variations. But what trait dimensions describe personality? If you had an upcoming blind date, what personality traits would give you an accurate sense of the person? Alport and his associate, H.S. Odbert, literally counted all the words in an unabridged dictionary with which one could describe people. This amounted to almost 18,000 words. The challenge was then to determining how to condense the list to a manageable number of basic traits. One way to condense the list of descriptive words has been to propose traits such as anxiety that some theory regards as basic. A newer method is factor analysis, which is a statistical procedure used to identify clusters of test items that tap basic components of intelligence, such as spatial ability, reasoning ability, or verbal skill. Imagine that people who describe themselves as outgoing also tend to say that they like excitement and practical jokes, and dislike quiet reading. Such a statistically correlated cluster of behaviors reflects a basic trait, or factor, in this case, a trait called extroversion. British psychologist Hans Eysenck and Syllable Eysenck believe that we can reduce many of our normal individual variations to two or three genetically influenced dimensions, including extroversion, introversion, and emotional stability and instability. Their Eysenck personality questionnaire has been given to people in 35 countries around the world. When people's answers were analyzed, the extroversion and emotional factors inevitably emerge as basic personality dimensions. There is also growing evidence that our biology influences personality factors. Extroverts seek stimulation because their normal brain arousal is relatively low. PET scans show that a frontal lobe area involved in behavior inhibition is less active in extroverts than in introverts. Jerome Kagan attributes differences in children's shyness and inhibition to their autonomic nervous system reactivity. Given a reactive autonomic nervous system, we respond to stress with greater anxiety and inhibition. Our genes have much to say about the temperament and the behavioral style that will define our personalities, more, it seems, than the way our parents handled us. The fearless, curious child may become the rock-climbing or fast-driving adult. When assessing the trait perspective, it is important to remember that assessment techniques derived from trait concepts do not reveal hidden personality dynamics, but instead they profile a person's behavior patterns. Many trait scales provide quick assessments of a single trait, such as extroversion, anxiety, or self-esteem. Alternatively, psychologists assess several traits at once by administering personality inventories, which are longer questionnaires on which people respond to items covering a wide range of feelings and behaviors. The most extensively researched and widely used personality inventory is the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, or MMPI. Although it assesses abnormal personality tendencies rather than normal personality traits, the MMPI illustrates a good way of developing a personality inventory. The MMPI items were empirically derived in that, from a large pool of items, Hathaway and his colleagues selected those on which particular diagnostic groups differed. They then grouped the questions into 10 clinical scales. Self-report personality tests are the most widely used method of assessing traits. But psychologist David Funder believes that peer reports provide more trustworthy information. Friends who have observed you repeatedly in everyday situations provide the acid test for judging you. More often than not, self-reports and peer reports tend to agree. But when they disagree, Funder would put his money on the peer reports. If everyone who knows you agrees you are outgoing, then regardless of what you think, you are outgoing. Today's trait researchers believe that earlier trait dimensions are important, but they do not tell the whole story. A slightly expanded set of factors called the Big Five does a better job. This set includes measures of emotional stability and extroversion, just like the MMPI, but also includes measures of openness, agreeableness, and conscientiousness. Each of these five factors has three scales of the dimension. For emotional stability, the scales are calm, anxious, secure, insecure, and self-satisfied, self-pitying. For extroversion, the scales are sociable, retiring, fun-loving, sober, affectionate, reserved. For openness, the scales are imaginative, practical. Preferences for variety or preferences for routine, independent, conforming. For agreeableness, the scales are soft-hearted, ruthless, trusting, suspicious, helpful, uncooperative. For conscientiousness, the scales are organized, disorganized, careful, careless, and disciplined, impulsive. With all the personality tests available, we still need to explore the question regarding if our personality traits are stable and enduring. Or does our behavior depend on where and with whom we find ourselves? This has been termed the person-situation controversy. What researchers have found is that both viewpoints are true. Our behavior is influenced by the interaction of our inner disposition with our environment. But which is more important? Forced to choose, most people would probably side with the stable and enduring viewpoint. Until the late 1960s, researchers would have as well. But research regarding genuine personality traits that persist over time and across situations tends to side with the viewpoint of shifting our behavior depending on the environment. Research shows that people's scores on personality tests only mildly predict their behavior. For example, people's scores on an extroversion test do not neatly predict how sociably they actually will be on any given occasion. If we remember such results, we will be more cautious about labeling and pigeonholing individuals. In unfamiliar, formal situations, such as when being a guest in the home of a person from another culture, our traits may remain hidden as we attend carefully to social cues. In familiar informal situations, such as just hanging out with friends, we feel less constrained, allowing our traits to emerge. In such situations, our expressive styles, such as our animation, manner of speaking, and gestures, are impressively consistent. Thus, we often form lasting impressions within a few minutes of meeting someone. Added to this, researchers have also shown that if you ask someone who does not rate high on the expressiveness scale to act or pretend to be expressive, they still do not appear to be as expressive as someone who is naturally high on this scale. Thus, we can say that at any moment, the immediate situation powerfully influences a person's behavior, especially when a situation makes clear demands. Averaging our behavior across many occasions does reveal that we have distinct personality traits. Moreover, we can quickly perceive individual differences in some traits, such as expressiveness. As we complete this topic, use this multiple choice question to test your understanding. Which of the following statements regarding contemporary perspectives of personality psychology is false? Is it that contemporary perspectives focus on grand theories? Did Gordon Allport describe personality in terms of fundamental traits? Did William Sheldon describe personality in terms of body type? Do contemporary psychologists tend to use a statistical procedure called factor analysis to identify clusters of test items? Is agreeableness one of the Big Five factors? It is the first statement that was false. Contemporary perspectives focus on the analysis of basic dimensions and their impact on behavior, not on grand theories. Albert Bandura proposed a modern personality perspective called the social cognitive perspective, which emphasizes the interaction of persons and their situations. Like learning theorists, social cognitive theorists believe we learn many of our behaviors either through conditioning or by observing others and modeling our behavior after theirs. They also emphasize the importance of mental processes. What we think about our situation affects our behavior. Instead of focusing solely on how our environment controls us, which would be behaviorism, social cognitive theorists focus on how we and our environment interact, how we interpret and respond to external events. It asks the question, how do our schemas, our memories, and our expectations influence our behavior patterns? In 1986, Bandura called the process of interacting with our environment reciprocal determinism. According to Bandura, behavior, internal personal factors, and environmental influences all operate as interlocking determinants of each other. The influences are mutual. Bandura outlines three specific ways in which individuals and environments interact. First, different people choose different environments. The school you attend, the reading you do, the television programs you watch, the music you listen to, the friends you associate with, all are part of an environment you have chosen, based partially on your dispositions. Therefore, you choose your environment, and it then shapes you. Second, our personalities shape how we interpret and react to events. Anxious people, for example, are attuned to potentially threatening events. Thus, they perceive the world as threatening, and they react accordingly. Third, our personalities help create situations to which we react. Many experiments reveal that how we view and treat people influences how they in turn treat us. If we expect someone to be angry with us, we may give the person a cold shoulder, touching off the very anger we expected. If we have an easygoing temperament, we will likely enjoy close, supportive friendships. So in some ways, we are both the products and the architects of our environments. It does reinforce the concept that at every moment, our behavior is influenced by our genes, our experiences, and our personalities. In studying how we interact with our environment, social cognitive psychologists emphasize our sense of personal control. Whether we learn to see ourselves as controlling or as controlled by our environment. Psychologists have two basic ways to study the effect of personal control, or any personality factor. First, they can correlate people's feelings of control with their behaviors and achievements. Secondly, they can experiment by raising or lowering people's sense of control and noting the effects. Hundreds of studies have compared people who differ in their perceptions of control. On the one side are those who have what is called an external locus of control, the perception that chance or outside forces determine their fate. On the other are those who perceive an internal locus of control and believe that, to a great extent, they control their own destiny. In study after study, internals achieve more in school, act more independently, enjoy better health, and feel less depressed than do externals. Moreover, they are better able to delay gratification and cope with various stresses, including marital problems. Self-control is the ability to control impulses and delay gratification, and in turn it predicts good judgments, good adjustments, better grades, and social success. None of us, however, experiences unvarying self-control. Like a muscle, self-control temporarily weakens after an exertion, replenishes with rest, and becomes stronger with exercise. Self-control requires attention and energy. People who feel helpless and oppressed often perceive control as external. This perception may then deepen their feelings of resignation. In fact, this is exactly what researchers have found. Dogs strapped to a harness and given repeated shocks with no opportunity to avoid them learned a sense of helplessness. Later placed in another situation where they could escape the punishment by simply leaping a hurdle, the dogs cowered as if without hope. Repeatedly faced with traumatic events over which they have no control, people too come to feel helpless, hopeless, and depressed. Psychologists call this passive resignation learned helplessness. In contrast, animals able to escape the shocks in the first situation learned personal control and easily escaped the shocks in the new situation. Other studies provided opportunities for some control of the environment and produced some reassuring results. Under conditions of democracy, personal freedom, and empowerment, people thrive. One measure of how helpless or effective you feel is where you stand on optimism-pessimism. Perhaps you have known students whose attributional style is negative, who attribute poor performance to their lack of ability by statements such as, "I can't do this," or to situations enduringly beyond their control, such as, "There's nothing I can do about it." Such students are more likely to persist in getting low grades compared to students who adapt the more hopeful attitude that effort, good study habits, and self-discipline can make a difference. Although mere fantasies tend not to fuel motivation and success, genuine positive expectations do. Health, too, benefits from a basic optimism. A depressed hopelessness dampens the body's disease-fighting immune system. In repeated studies, optimists have outlived pessimists or lived with fewer illnesses. When optimism is combined with a dash of realism, great advances can be made. Self-disparaging explanations of past failures can depress ambition, but realistic anxiety over possible future failures can fuel energetic efforts to avoid the dreaded fate. Students who, concerned about bombing the upcoming exam, study thoroughly and get a top grade often outperform their equally able but overconfident peers. Success requires enough optimism to provide hope and enough pessimism to prevent complacency. Excessive optimism can also blind us to real risks. Neil Weinstein has shown how our natural positive thinking bias can promote an unrealistic optimism about future life events. Most college students perceive themselves as less likely than their average classmate to develop drinking problems, to drop out of school, or have a heart attack by age 40. Our natural positive thinking bias does seem to vanish, however, when we are bracing ourselves for feedback, as when we are about to receive exam results. Given illusory optimism, documented in some 200 research reports, people may fail to take sensible precautions. Most young Americans know that half of U.S. marriages end in divorce, but they are confident that theirs will not. Most cigarette smokers smoke high tar brands, but only 17% believe their brand has a more hazardous tar level than most others. Ironically, people often are most overconfident when most incompetent. That's because, according to Justin Kruger and David Dunning, it often takes competence to recognize competence. They found that most students scoring at the low end of tests of grammar and logic believed they had scored in the top half. If you do not know what good grammar is, you may be unaware that your grammar is poor. The difficulty in recognizing one's own incompetence helps explain why so many low-scoring students are dumbfounded after doing badly on an exam. Social cognitive researchers explore the effect of differing situations on people's behavior patterns and attitudes. They study, for example, how viewing aggressive or non-aggressive models affect behavior. They assess the impact of dehumanizing situations on people's attitudes, and they examine the consistency of people's personalities in varying circumstances. Military and educational organizations and many Fortune 500 companies are continuing this type of study in their evaluations of hundreds of thousands of people each year in assessment centers. These procedures exploit the principle that the best means of predicting future behavior is neither a personality test nor an interviewer's intuition. Rather, it is the person's past behavior patterns in similar situations. As long as the situation and the person remain much the same, the best predictor of future job performance is past job performance. The best predictor of future grades is past grades. The best predictor of future aggressiveness is past aggressiveness. The best predictor of drug use in young adulthood is drug use in high school. If you can't check the person's past behavior, the next best thing is to create an assessment situation that simulates the demands of the task so you can see how the person handles them. The social cognitive perspective on personality synthesizes researchers to how situations affect or are affected by individuals. More than other perspectives, it builds from psychological research on learning and cognition. But critics charge that the social cognitive perspectives focus so much on the situation that it fails to appreciate the person's inner traits. Where is the person in this view of personality? And where are human emotions? True, the situation does guide our behavior, but, says the critic, in many instances, our unconscious motives, our emotions, and our pervasive traits shine through. Personality traits have been shown to predict behavior at work, love, and play. Our biologically influenced traits really do matter. As we complete this topic, take a moment to attempt the following matching question regarding the social cognitive perspective of personality psychology. The terms are Albert Bandura, optimism-pessimism scale, reciprocal influence, and internal locus of control. The possible characteristics are how we view and treat people influences how they in turn treat us, emphasize the interaction of persons with their situations, to a great extent each person has control of their own destiny, and helps measure helplessness effectiveness. How would you match these? Well, Albert Bandura emphasized the interaction of persons with their situations. The optimism-pessimism scale helps measure helplessness effectiveness. Reciprocal influence involves the concept of how we view and treat people influences how they in turn treat us. And the premise of the internal locus of control is that, to a great extent, each person has control of their own destiny. In our final topic, we will explore personality differences. We will start with a look at the sense of self, and then delve into self-esteem and into cultural influences. We will complete this tutorial with a look at the modern unconscious mind. Let's begin. Psychology's concern with people's sense of self dates back at least to William James, who, in his 1890 Principles of Psychology, devoted more than 100 pages to this topic. By 1943, Gordon Elport lamented that the self had become lost to view. Even humanistic psychology's emphasis on the self did not instigate much scientific research, but it did help renew the concept of self and keep it alive. Now, more than a century after James and outside humanistic psychology, the self is one of Western psychology's most vigorously researched topics. Every year, new studies galore appear about self-esteem, self-disclosure, self-awareness, self-schemas, self-monitoring, and so forth. More than 150,000 articles in all since 1967. Underlying this research is an assumption that the self, as organizer of our thoughts, feelings, and actions, is a pivotal center of personality. From our self-focused perspective, we readily presume that others are noticing and evaluating us. In 1996, Thomas Gilovich demonstrated this spotlight effect by having individual Cornell University students don Barry Manilow t-shirts before entering a room filled with other students. Feeling self-conscious, the t-shirt wearers guessed that nearly half of their peers would take note of the shirt as they walked in. In reality, only 23% did. This absence of attention applies not only to our clothes and hair, but also to our nervousness, irritation, or attraction. Fewer people notice than we presume. Others are also less aware than we suppose of the variability, the ups and downs, of our appearance and performance. Self-focus affects our recall as well, but in a more constructive way. We remember information better if we encode it in terms of ourselves. The correlational links between low self-esteem and personal problems have other possible interpretations. Many researchers doubt that self-esteem is really the armor that protects kids from life's problems. Could it not be the other way around? Couldn't problems and failures cause low self-esteem? Maybe self-esteem simply reflects reality. Maybe feeling good follows doing well. Maybe it's a side effect of meeting challenges and surmounting difficulties. Maybe self-esteem is a gauge that reads out the state of our relationships with others. Using this logic, will the best boost to self-esteem, therefore, come not so much from our repeatedly telling children how wonderful they are, as from their own effective coping and hard-won achievements? An effect of low self-esteem does appear in experiments. If you temporarily deflate a person's self-image, they will be more likely to disparage others or to express heightened racial prejudice. Those who are negative about themselves also tend to be thin-skinned and judgmental. In experiments, those made to feel insecure often become excessively critical. Such findings are consistent with Maslow's and Rogers' presumptions that a healthy self-image pays dividends. Accept yourself, and you'll find it easier to accept others. Is it true, as so many assume, that ethnic minorities, people with disabilities, and women live lives handicapped by impoverished self-esteem? The accumulated evidence says no. According to Jennifer Crocker and Brenda Major, the members of stigmatized groups who have faced discrimination and lower status, yet maintain their self-esteem, do so in three ways. First, they value the things at which they excel. Second, they attribute problems to prejudice. And third, they do as everyone does. They compare themselves to those in their own group. These findings help us understand why, despite the realities of prejudice, such groups report levels of happiness roughly comparable to others. Most of us have a good reputation with ourselves. In studies of self-esteem, even those who score low respond in the mid-range of possible scores. Moreover, one of the psychology's most provocative and firmly established recent conclusions concerns our potent self-serving bias, our readiness to perceive ourselves favorably. Research shows that people accept more responsibility for good deeds than for bad, and for successes more than for failures. For example, athletes often privately credit their victories to their own prowess and their losses to bad breaks, lousy officiating, or the other team's exceptional performance. After receiving poor grades on an exam, most students in a half dozen studies criticize the exam, not themselves. What have I done to deserve this? Is one question we usually ask of our troubles, not our successes. Those we assume we deserve. Research also shows that most people see themselves as better than average. This is true for nearly any subjective and socially desirable dimension. In several studies, 90% of business managers and more than 90% of college professors rated their performance as superior to that of their average peer. The phenomenon, which reflects the overestimation of self rather than the underestimation of others, is less striking in Asia, where people value modesty. Yet self-serving biases have been observed worldwide. Ironically, people even see themselves as more immune than others to self-serving bias. The effects of self-serving bias are widespread. We remember and justify our past actions in self-enhancing ways. We exhibit an inflated confidence in our beliefs and judgments. We overestimate how desirably we would act in situations where most people have less than admirably. We often seek out favorable, self-enhancing information. We are quicker to believe flattering descriptions of ourselves than unflattering ones, and we are impressed with psychological tests that make us look good. We shore up our self-image by overestimating how much others support our opinions and share our foibles, and by underestimating the commonality of our strengths. And lastly, we exhibit group pride, a tendency to see our group be it our school, our country, or our race, as superior. When people find their self-esteem threatened, those with large egos may do more than put others down. They may react violently. Someone with a swelled head that gets deflated by insult or rejection is potentially dangerous. Recognizing both the perils of self-righteousness and the dividends of positive self-esteem, psychologists have suggested that humans function best with modest self-enhancing illusions. When looking at the relationship between culture and the self, two concepts need to be discussed. First, individualism. Individualism involves giving priority to one's own goals over group goals and defining one's ability and identity in terms of personal attributes rather than group identifications. The second term is collectivism. Collectivism involves giving priority to the goals of one's group, which is often one's extended family or work group, and defining one's identity accordingly. To an individualist, the person's identity, the sense of me, the awareness of his or her personal convictions and values, are most important. Individualists strive for personal control and individual achievement. Individualism varies from person to person within any culture, and cultures vary in complex ways. Yet, cross-cultural psychologists have discovered some variations across cultures, ranging from the individualism of the United States, outside the Deep South, to the collectivism of rural Asia. Collectivist gains identity from their family, groups, and loyal friends. These connections help define who he or she is. In a collectivist culture, a social network provides one's bearings. By their group's identifications, collectivists gain a sense of belonging, a sense of values, a network of caring individuals, and assurance of security. Being more self-contained, individualists more easily move in and out of social groups. They feel relatively free to switch churches, leave one job for another, or even to leave their extended families and migrate to a new place. Marriage is often for as long as they both shall love. In contrast, collectivists may act shy in new groups and are more easily embarrassed. They have deeper, more stable attachments to their family groups and familiar groups and families. Relationships are long-term. Loyalties run strong between employer and employees. Valuing communal solidarity, people in collectivist cultures place a premium on maintaining harmony and making sure others never lose face. Direct confrontation and blunt honesty are rare, as are expressions of personal egotism. Elders and superiors are given respect. The collectivist self is not independent, but interdependent. No one is an island. Rather, happiness is being attuned to others. Both individualism and collectivism offer benefits and come at a cost. People in competitive individualistic cultures have more personal freedom, take more pride in personal achievements, are less geographically bound to their families, and enjoy more privacy. Their less unified cultures offer a smorgasbord of lifestyles and invite individuals to construct their own identities. These cultures also celebrate innovation and creativity, and they tend to respect individual human rights. Studies indicate that people in individualistic cultures report experiencing greater happiness than do those in collectivist cultures. When individualists pursue their own ends and all goes well, life can seem rewarding. Curiously, though, within individualistic cultures, people with the strongest social ties express greatest satisfaction with their lives. Moreover, the seeming benefits of individualism can come at the cost of more loneliness, more divorce, more homicide, and more stress-related disease. Individualists demand more romance and personal fulfillment in marriage, which subjects the marriage relationship to more pressure. The last topic we will discuss in this tutorial involves the modern unconscious mind. Cognitive science reveals that, more than most of us realize, our lives are guided by off-screen, out-of-sight, non-conscious information processing. The unconscious mind is huge. We now know that Freud was right about at least one thing. We indeed have limited access to all that goes on in our minds. In fact, our capacity for unconscious learning is quite sophisticated. Experiments have shown that people's non-conscious learning can anticipate patterns too complex and too confusing to be consciously noticed. Although some experiments point to a vast realm of out-of-sight information, the iceberg notion held by today's research psychologists differ from Freud's, with some believing it might actually be time to abandon Freud's view of the unconscious. Many now think of the unconscious not as seething passions and repressive censoring, but as cooler information processing that occurs without our awareness. The following is a list of things these researchers believe is involved in the unconscious: the schemas that automatically control our perceptions and interpretations, the priming by stimuli to which we have not consciously attended, the right hemisphere activity that enables the split brain patient's left hand to carry out an instruction the patient cannot verbalize, the parallel processing of different aspects of vision and thinking, the implicit memories that operate without conscious recall, even among those with amnesia, the emotions that activate instantly before conscious analysis, and the self-concept and stereotypes that automatically and unconsciously influence how we process information about ourselves and others. More than we realize, we fly on autopilot. This understanding of unconscious information processing is more like the pre-Freudian view of an underground stream of thought from which spontaneous creative ideas surface. Recent history has supported Freud's idea that we defend ourselves against anxiety. Again, however, the contemporary idea differs from Freud's in exactly how we do this. In 1997, studies reported a terror management theory, which stated that one source of anxiety is the terror resulting from our awareness of vulnerability and death. Studies that tested this theory show that thinking about one's mortality provokes enough anxiety to intensify prejudices. Death anxiety motivates contempt for others and esteem for oneself. Faced with a threatening world, people act not only to enhance their self-esteem, but also to adhere more strongly to worldviews that answer questions about life's meaning. Moreover, they cleave to close relationships. Recent research has also provided some support for Freud's idea of defense mechanisms, but again, they don't seem to work exactly as Freud supposed. For example, one study conducted in 1998 found that people tend to see their foibles and attitudes in others, a phenomenon that Freud called projection, and that today's researchers call the false consensus effect, the tendency to overestimate the effect to which others share our beliefs and behaviors. People who cheat on their taxes or break speed limits tend to think many others do likewise. People falsely told that they are high in repressed anger or dishonesty tend more to see such in others. Moreover, when trying to suppress thinking about our own faults, we become more likely to see them in others. Supportive evidence is, however, meager for other defenses, such as displacement, that are tied to instinctual energy. More evidence exists for defenses such as reaction formation that defend self-esteem. Defense mechanisms, psychologists conclude, are motivated less by the seething impulses that Freud presumed than by our need to protect our self-image. As we complete this topic, use this multiple choice question to test your understanding. Which of the following statements is true regarding personality differences? Is it that low self-esteem is a side effect of meeting challenges and surmounting difficulties? Or contemporary thinking agrees with Freud in that we have limited access to all that goes on in our minds? or we remember information worse if we encode it in terms of ourselves. Or the false consensus effect states that we assume that others are noticing and evaluating us. Or contemporary thinking concludes that defense mechanisms are indeed motivated by the seething impulses that Freud presumed. Which statement was true? It is the second statement that is true. Contemporary thinking agrees with Freud in that we have limited access to all that goes on in our minds. The first statement was false. It is high self-esteem, not low self-esteem, that is a side effect of meeting challenges and surmounting difficulties. And we remember information better, not worse, if we encode it in terms of ourselves. And it's the spotlight effect that states we assume that others are noticing and evaluating us. And lastly, contemporary thinking concludes that self-defense mechanisms are not motivated by the seething impulses that Freud presumed, but instead function to protect our self-image. This tutorial explored personality psychology. As such, we covered three main topics. After a brief introduction, we first explored historical perspectives on personality psychology to include the psychoanalytic and humanistic perspectives. We then explored more contemporary perspectives to include the trait and social cognitive perspectives. We completed this tutorial with an exploration of how personality psychologists view personality differences by focusing on the sense of self, self-esteem, the influence of culture, and finished with a look at the modern unconscious mind. Congratulations in completing the rapid learning tutorial on personality psychology. For more science and math tutorials, go to www.rapidlearningcenter.com.